This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. President Clinton has a reputation for being more involved in writing his speeches than most presidents, often even ad-libbing at the podium. My guest Michael Waldman says this is true, and he should know. From 1995 to 1999, Waldman served as the president's director of speech writing. He started writing for the president in 1993 and joined his staff during his presidential campaign. Waldman wrote or edited nearly 2,000 speeches or policy statements for the president and worked with him on 2 inaugural addresses, 1 convention address, and 4 State of the Unions. He now teaches at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Waldman has written a new book called POTUS Speaks. POTUS is the acronym for President of the United States. I asked Michael Waldman what he considers the best speech he helped write.
There are a lot of speeches I was very proud of, but interestingly, for me, the speech I was proudest of was not one that was memorably eloquent, but memorably effective. It was the 1998 State of the Union address. If you remember, that speech happened just a week after the world learned about Monica Lewinsky, and it was a crazy time. Nobody was sure whether he would be able to get up and do it. Nobody was sure what he would say. People speculated he might be resigning. And we were able to pull that speech together and very much have a huge impact on policy at a time of almost surreal pressure.
When you found out about the Monica story, what were your reactions about what the State of the Union address should be? I mean, did you initially think he should say something about the allegations or that he should ignore that the allegations existed?
Well, once I got over my initial surprise, and it's worth pointing out that those of us on the White House staff basically had the same reaction to all this all along as most people watching. I thought that he should focus.
Which was what? You mean surprise?
Which was surprise and disappointment, uh-huh. But it wasn't something I was expecting.
Right.
The day before, I had seen a friend of mine who was the special counsel for the president who dealt with all these various investigations, and I had said to him, you know, this is the one week of the year that my job is harder than your job. And then overnight, the whole Lewinsky thing blew up, and I saw him, and I said, that's what I call one-upsmanship. I thought it was really important that he focus on policy, on his goals for the country. And if at all possible, he should find a way to not have to talk about the unfolding scandal in the State of the Union address. Now, if you remember, in the end, he spoke about it the day before, perhaps unfortunately, in answer to reporters' questions. But I really thought that it would be far better if he could focus on the work at hand. One of the reasons was I knew that if he'd said even one sentence about it, then that was what the press would focus on. That was what the headlines would be. And I think he was convinced to do that, and he wanted to do it that way from the beginning also. The reality is he had a lot he wanted to talk about that year on the budget deficit, on Social Security, and on other policies. It was as a matter of policy, it was a very powerful speech, and I think he knew that that was what would carry him forward.
Did you ever during that period ask him point blank whether the allegations were true?
No. For 2 reasons. One is, as we found out, people who asked that had to get lawyers. go before grand juries later on. And I'd been around the White House long enough to know that this wasn't just a salacious story in the press. This was a criminal investigation, and even innocent conversations among people were prone to being misinterpreted. But also, it would have been entirely inappropriate, I thought, for me to do that. I was trying to focus on the speech. And in my experience, to a remarkable degree, that was what he was focusing on, too. I remember just how tense the whole thing was when you drove into work. The camera crews were following you to see if you were anybody, and it was a sense of a White House under siege. And walking around the West Wing, every TV set was tuned to Mike McCurry, the press secretary's briefing, which was that day being carried live on all the networks, not just in the briefing room. And McCurry was being bloodied. You know, the reporters were asking question after question. And my pager went off in the middle of this. It said, call the Oval Office. And the president got on the line. And I didn't know what he was going to be talking about. And he said, have you read the memo from Stephen Carter, the Yale law professor? And I had read it 2 hours before, but even I couldn't remember what it said because of all this other stuff going on. And I said, yes, sir. Yes, Mr. President. He said, well, look on page 2. I really like the language about the idea of America and some rhetorical suggestions. I think you should use it, and I'll send it out to you. And we hung up, and I looked back at the TV set, and McCurry was still being pummeled. And it was quite amazing that at this moment of maximum peril to him and to the presidency, that at least at some level he was able to focus on the speech and on getting it done.
What do you think was most effective about the speech?
Well, in the middle of the craziness of the Lewinsky crisis, at his weakest moment politically, Clinton really was able to deliver his most effective speech. He got up there, and this was a line that he had worked with us to craft. He got up and said, we have a brand new budget surplus, which nobody had seen in decades. We have a new budget surplus. What should we do with it? I have a simple four-word answer. Save Social Security first. Well, the Democrats jumped up and applauded. They were applauding semicolons by this point. And Gingrich thought about it for an instant, and he stood up and applauded. And the Republicans in the Congress looked at each other and looked at him, and they stood up and applauded. And they had been determined to use the surplus for a tax cut, which would have had huge consequences. But at that moment, with everyone standing up and applauding on national TV, $1 trillion shifted in the budget from the Karl Marx tax cut to the Karl Marx Social Security. That's where it stayed ever since. And that moment has set the stage for this election and the budget priorities of the next several years at least. And this was the most amazing thing was about it. It was at the depths of the Lewinsky crisis. It to me, it was the most powerful use of the bully pulpit the whole time I worked with Clinton.
Let's talk about the most famous presidential speech snafu during the Clinton administration to date. And that was the time when the wrong speech was on his teleprompter. Tell us what happened.
In September of 1993, he went before the Congress to put forth his health plan for national health insurance. And somehow, the wrong speech got put on the teleprompter. It was the speech that he had delivered outlining his economic plan nearly a year before. And he got up there and saw that it was the wrong speech. And for about 10 minutes while they figured out what went wrong, he basically vamped and ad-libbed from memory and from having been in the middle of writing the speech, the first 10 minutes of the speech. And then eventually the teleprompter caught up. Now, I'm happy to say I wasn't involved in that particular snafu, but I was relieved at the same time because I had been responsible for my own snafu a week before that people really never heard about.
And what was that?
When the president launched his fight for NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement with Mexico and Canada, in the East Room, you'll remember he had President Carter and Ford and Bush there. And what happened was he was given a set of talking points or a speech that I'd written to choose from, and he chose to do the speech. But the folks who printed out the speech printed the wrong version of the speech. The first draft, rather with, in a sense, placeholder numbers, rather than the fact-checked final draft. And he went up there and read it, and I think partway through he realized what had happened. And I was there in the East Room, and I practically fainted. And later that day, we put out some corrections and told people that some of the numbers were wrong. And the press thought, we said it was a staff error, and the press was very skeptical because how could it be, how is that possible that there could be an error like that? But that's actually what happened. But the reality is nobody in that intense fight over NAFTA, the other side, never quite figured out what had happened. All I could think of was those movies of the early rocket launches where the rockets blew up on the launch pad and that was what we were about to have happen. And so, as I say, when the mess-up happened with the teleprompter a week later, I was at least somewhat relieved that it had happened again more publicly than my own errors.
You were working with Dick Morris on one of the speeches for the president, and you had written something that Dick Morris then made slightly more concise and changed to, "The era of big government is over, but the era of every man for himself must never begin." And then it went through several other people's eyes who read it, and it was accused of being a sexist line because the era of every man for himself was male-gendered. What did you think? Did you think that that was sexist? Did you think that that needed to be changed?
At the time, I didn't see it that way. Although, when I tell the story now, enough people say to me that they thought it was sexist that maybe it was the right call. What happened was, Clinton always talked about his third way approach, not a traditional liberalism and not Newt Gingrich style libertarian conservatism, but a third way. And that was what the sentence that I had written and the more concise version that Morris suggested was trying to convey. And we thought that saying the era of big government is over would lead to a big ideological fight within the White House. But it was, in fact, the second half of the sentence, the era of every man for himself must never begin, was people said that was sexist. And so we spent days trying to think of what the second half of the sentence should be after the president, you know, basically agreed that we should change it. You're on your own, fend for yourself. We thought about all these things. And interestingly, the result was that when he got up and said the era of big government is over, the second half of the sentence was a very soggy, long clause. I don't even remember. It was something like, we must not go back, to go forward to a time when you're on your own and everybody is, whatever it was, it wasn't remotely as memorable as the era of big government is over. And that was what the headlines had, and that was what people remembered. At the time, I joked that political correctness killed liberalism and it was an accidental homicide. It was one of those moments where you really realize that a president, with the way he talks about policy, can really set a tone and have an impact.
Did you run into those kind of gender problems a lot with language?
Interestingly, not really. It was something that you had to be careful about. Where it was interesting was President Clinton, like a lot of other speakers, often would like to go back to the founding documents, talking about the ideals for the country. Now, the Declaration of Independence said, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. We would usually paraphrase that, actually, to take the quote marks out and say we are all created equal, but not always. I think you have to be careful, but usually you can. Clinton was pretty deft about those things, and if we didn't catch it, he would.
My guest is Michael Waldman, President Clinton's former director of speech writing. He's written a new book called POTUS Speaks. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.